You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, we're talking with Aaron Katz. He's in London at the moment and is an artist and researcher as well as curator. Aaron, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Aaron, let's talk a little bit about what you're working on at the moment, or if you'd like, where things began. But either way, I know I wanted to talk to you about, you know, tissue culture and art projects and other things that you're doing. But perhaps we should begin with what you're working on now, if that's appropriate.
Yeah, it sounds good, because actually it links to how I started 20 years ago. So I'm currently at the Royal College of Arts in London, acting as a visiting professor of a new area that we're exploring, which we refer to as contestable design. The idea here is to come in and help mainly the design school, but hopefully the whole college, in coming to terms with the idea of the contestable, in particular when it comes to emerging knowledge and technologies, and specifically around the life sciences. So the idea is that life is becoming a raw material, something to be engineered, and this is something I identified 20 years ago when I started the Tissue Culture and Art Project, predicting that in some stage in the future, designers would start to design living biological systems. And 20 years later, here I am in the Royal College of Arts trying to help them to do that. But throughout this journey of the last 20 years, I became more and more concerned with the lack of our cultural ability to deal with what's going on with life. So that's why it's contestable rather than desirable.
That's very interesting, Sylvia, because I've never heard of that term contestable design before. And, you know, it sounds like because there's an argument against it. And is there an argument against it, and why exactly is it called contestable design?
Yeah, so the idea here is really to put forward prototypes, and my interest, as opposed to work that was done, especially here at the Royal College of Arts, around the idea of the speculative, I'm less interested in the speculative, I'm much more interested in the actual, but I want to put forward those types of prototypes of examples of what we can do with life at the moment. But I'm not necessarily endorsing them. I'm not necessarily saying that this is the right way to go. I'm really interested in using those prototypes as objects for cultural discussion. As I mentioned, I think that we're living in a really interesting time where our relationship to life is shifting and changing, and there's an increasing incompatibility, if you like, between how we as a culture, how we as a society thinking about life, and then what's happening in labs around the world, how life is being manipulated and shifting and changing and becoming a raw material. And I'm also very, very interested in kind of bringing some of the old discussions that took place, especially at the late 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, around very similar issues. And my concern is that we're suffering from acute cultural amnesia, which means that the type of stories that to some extent led to undesirable ways in which our relationship to life kind of manifested itself in regard to how we treated each other is coming back without any recognition of the fact that we are trying to control life to such an extent that by extension we're also trying to do it to our fellow human beings.
So let's talk about examples, because of course I'm very interested in that and what you're saying. I'm sure the audience is. What would be an example of the kind of things you're introducing now, as you were saying, that you know, you may or may not endorse, but what does that mean? What is the disconnect between what's happening all around the world in labs, as you were saying, and what many people are thinking? Perhaps we can start with an example of what would be contestable.
Yeah, I think a very timely example, and something that, you know, we've been dealing with for a while, is the field of in vitro meat. So I don't know if you know, but apparently myself and Yonat Zur, my collaborator, were the first people to ever grow and eat a piece of lab that was grown in the lab without basically an animal, or without using animals directly as part of the production of this piece of meat. The first piece of meat that we grown was back in the year 2000. The lab that we worked in didn't have a license to grow food, so we couldn't eat it, and we could only eat a piece of meat that we grown as part of an art installation. in as part of an exhibition called L'Art Biotech in Nantes in France in 2003. So that was a performative installation called Disembodied Cuisine, where we basically took a piece of, basically some cells from frogs, muscle cells from frogs, and we cultured them for the 3 months of the exhibition, and at the very last day of the exhibition, we ate them. Now, as artists, at the time, we were much more interested in this whole idea of in vitro meat as a way to deal with some of the issues concerning the new relationship to life and our relationship to other life forms. You can't get more intimate with another life form than consuming it and making it part of your own body. So that was our interest. We've never been interested in growing meat as a form of way of feeding the world. But interesting enough, now and in the last couple of years, this whole field of in vitro meat is really expanding. Lots of money is being invested into trying to do it as a commercial product.
Now, well, explain that more to me. I'm sorry to interrupt, but just to get really clear on what this in its in vitro meat, you're growing. How is that actually made, and is it similar to the performance you described, in the exhibition with the frog cells? How is that meat actually, produced? Is it in your eggs?
So basically, the practice of the Tissue Culture and Art Project since the very beginning, since the mid '90s, was to use the technology which is called tissue engineering. And the technology of tissue engineering is basically the ability to take fragments, cells and tissues from complex organisms and grow them outside of the body in a lab, inside specialized environments, which are often being referred to as bioreactors. So those environments provide the conditions for the tissues and the cells to grow. And the idea of tissue engineering was to try and grow three-dimensional tissue as functional tissue with the hope to create body spare parts. So I think one of the most famous examples of tissue engineering, although it wasn't really successful, was the mouse that had a human ear growing from its back. Yeah, so in this case, the scientist, and we've got, we never done an ear on the back of the mouse. We've grown ears, but never on mice. What the scientist did then was to create a three-dimensional scaffold, so basically sculpt a shape of an ear out of this material that, as they then seeded it with living cells, degraded, and living tissue replaced the synthetic material or those degradable polymers. So we were really interested in this technology because from our perspective, it highlighted some of the issues that are concerning the new relationship to life. Here you have fragments of complex living organisms growing outside of the original bodies by artificial means, but also they are kind of functioning to some extent, and that's when you started to talk about the idea of the semi-living. So in the case of the meat, it's a very similar technology where you basically, whatever shape you want the meat to be, like we decided to go quite simple, so the original meat we grew on was in shape of tiny coins, if you like scallops. And we started with this three-dimensional material, which in this case was very much like felt. So it's basically a mesh of this polymer, the fibers of the polymer that are kind of meshed together like felt. And then we seeded it with muscle cells or progenitor muscle cells, which are called satellite cells. And those cells are grown into a piece of meat, if you like. We transformed them. There was some other bits of basically maturing the cells into muscle cells. But in a sense, the essence is that you can grow a piece of muscle tissue outside of the body, and in a sense, that can be considered to be meat, and you can consume it. So,
but where was the muscle tissue from? At first I thought you were talking about the seafood, but you're talking about a muscle tissue from it could be any animal.
Exactly. So the original one was actually lamb, and it was, and we've done some other, in a sense, we've done also mouse meat. We never ate it. We're now actually working on a project that hopefully will be debuted in the Science Gallery in Dublin in a couple of months, where we basically going to grow insect meat as well using this technology. And the idea,
but you grew the lamb meat and you ate those kind of coins in a sense that came out of that. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah. Although no.
And
the
so
first
before,
one we ate
before,
was,
so, so, yeah. No. Go on.
Yeah. No. We couldn't eat the lamb cells or the lamb steaks because that lab didn't have the license. So the first meat that we grown and ate was frogs. So we used a very similar technology. But rather than muscles from a lamb, we used muscle cells from frogs that we then cultured in the lab that we built in the gallery for the 3 months of the performance.
Okay.
So, but as the idea of the contestable, what's really interesting in this context is that now you have companies that are investing quite a lot of money into try and develop it with the rhetoric of trying to solve the contemporary problems or the problems that are associated with contemporary modes of meat production. It's a very, very seductive idea, but when you come down to it, it's we believe that it's actually quite a flawed way of going about it. In a sense,
so let's talk about that before you go on. But what you're saying is there are companies, I mean, just correct me if I'm wrong, that want to, and this is a kind of common thing in the sciences and the arts, when things happen that seem to be breaking new ground, is they want to monetize it somehow. That's how they talk about it at Harvard and MIT here in the United States, and at Yale too, I imagine. Mm-hmm. But money goes into it. Seeing you know the potential huge outcome of making something like a different type of food that could make money as well as perhaps help many people. So then that's where we were, just to be clear, and that I'm not misunderstanding it. So then, and what happened next? What is the problem with that? Because that's interesting. Now you're spawning something that's also has a life of its own that you're in dialogue with.
Completely. And this is exactly, you hit the nail on its head. First of all, as artists who are dealing with the relationship to life and how attempts to control life, basically what we see more and more through things like synthetic biology or any other contemporary mode of biological engineering, which really seems to be where biology is, and as in kind of more of an engineering pursuit rather than a scientific discipline. The idea of control is one which is in the base of our work, but we are much more interested in the questioning the notion of control and intentionality. So as opposed to people who are trying to make money and they would use the rhetoric of control as a way to basically ensure that the venture capitalists would be happy, we are kind of destabilizing it because by definition, life is something that kind of grows out of control. And in the case of the in vitro meat, it is really interesting from our perspective because, as I mentioned, our original intentions were more about kind of how we deal with other life forms, how we consume them, how we interact with them in the most intimate ways, including consuming them and integrating them as being part of our own bodies, our own biological bodies. And then we start to see those companies that are using very, very similar technologies. Many cases don't even acknowledge the artists that have done it way before them. Many cases actually using similar strategies of performance. So the first unveiling of the industrial in vitro meat, if you like, was in a sense a performance here in London by a Dutch scientist called Mark Post, who basically, rather than produce a scientific paper, had a TV show style press conference where he got a chef to cook this meat and two people that he obviously selected tasted the meat and commented about what it was. And it was very much like a performance rather than any scientific, very similar to this type of the spectacle of science that was quite prevalent in the late 19th century. So we see kind of those kind of returns to this type of spectacle science as a way to attract and capture the public imagination. Now, what's really interesting from our perspective is that, in a sense, it's the really nice thing about in vitro meat, that although it's being hailed as a solution to the problem of contemporary modes of meat production, it's very much in our eyes a symptom of overconsumption, because it's not going to solve the problems of overconsuming meat. It's basically going to enhance that, recognizing the fact that most westernized humans who are eating meat are overconsuming meat. We never evolved to eat meat three times a day. That's not really... Meat was always a very special thing that humans were celebrating when they had access to it. But now people are excessively using it. And the idea, the very same guy, this Mark Post, his notion of how to solve the problems of the world is to his claim that in 20 years' time he would be the sole provider of meat to McDonald's. So what you see here is... Yeah, exactly. So what you see is kind of a rhetoric here. We're going to feed the world, but we're going to do it through the very same mindset and business kind of model that brought about McDonald's.
Right.
So, and then, on the larger scale of both our relationship to other life forms as well as kind of our place in the world, rather than trying to advocate the reduction in the use of meat or the consumption of meat, those companies are basically working on this idea that we should overconsume it. So on a political, on a kind of a political or economic level, this is one problem. The other problem is that when you start to think about the rhetoric of engineering life, which seems to be the prevailing rhetoric that we are kind of engaging with from kind of an ontological and philosophical perspective as artists, the notion of being able to grow meat outside of the body of the original animal from which it was taken, providing it conditions which in most cases you need to, you know, basically in order to grow those cells, you need to provide them with nutrients. The way those stories are being portrayed in the media is that the scientific lab where life is being manipulated and modified are now being kind of seen to be more of those magical black boxes. So when you read the kind of discourse around, for example, in vitro meat, you read about this idea that here we take stem cells from a cow and you take it to the lab and you get a steak at the end of the process. And then there's some kind of flawed calculations about how much more effective that is than growing meat on a cow. So there is kind of a really interesting case where basically this black box of science, of the lab, is an extremely resource-intensive place. And in the case of trying to grow meat, you need to feed the cells with nutrients which are so highly purified that sometimes we would have problems consuming them, so you actually have to degrade the quality of the nutrients through the animal cells so we can consume them. So it doesn't even make any engineering logic.
Right.
Yeah. So this is one aspect of our work. This is kind of this questioning and in a sense, trying to, I suppose, bring about ways in which we can, as artists, distill those notions of our relationship to other life forms, because as opposed to the scientists and the business people and the engineers that are working with living systems, we can't hide behind the notion of utility. So this is, I think, where art does what art does best, and that's kind of raising those questions without ever being able to say, we're going to fix the world. And I think we hear more and more the rhetoric of us going to fix the world, while I think there is a need for a growing number of people to question what does it mean to fix the world and at the expense of whom we are fixing the world. Yeah.
It's true, and then there's this kind of, you know, misinterpretation that happens sometimes. And as you were talking about, kind of like, you know, the way the popular media writes about it, things turning into, you know, for lack of a better word, you know, kind of extrapolated or junk science or something, where they're kind of making up things or riffing on even what's happening, right? By, you know, through miscalculations. I mean, this is
completely
also, I guess, part of what we have to embrace or look at it in terms of art, if that's what you're saying as well. It's
exactly
your art and dialogue with all of these things, I guess.
That's right. And you know, and again, this is kind of where art can play a really interesting role, because what we've seen also throughout the years is this, what I referred to before is the cultural amnesia to do with the stories that we told ourselves in the early 20th century. What we see now is actually those cycles of amnesia are getting shorter and shorter. So the whole story of in vitro meat, when we started working on it 15 years ago, 16 years ago now, I basically put an alert to whenever a new story would come up with in vitro meat, I would get a notice, and I could actually set up a calendar based on the way in which the media would pick up the story once every 6 months and tell the story as if it was never been told before, and get people excited again, as if they never heard about it before. And it would go in cycles, which is quite amazing. So I suppose as a communication media aspect, here you also have a really interesting type of you know, us being the people who are now being credited as the first to do it, we're positioned in a very strange place. You know, the companies need to acknowledge us. They need to reference us. But we are not here to say this is the great way to go forward. We're not here to say this is a great way for us to make money as artists. We're not really interested in those aspects. We're interested in the cultural discussion and in a sense, disrupting and subverting the way this cultural discussion takes place, not to give a sole voice to those people who are trying to basically manipulate us.
Very good. Yeah, that's it very well. And so to then, in closing, let's talk a little, because this is, you know, in a sense, we're talking about your art now, and obviously where you're involved in teaching and in terms of curating. You have an upcoming show or a project right now. Could you just describe a little bit how that's put together? Because I imagine that's part of the context that we're still in
yes,
this discussion.
So, that's right. So first of all, as you mentioned, I wear quite a few different hats. So another hat I wear is the director of Symbiotica, which is the first artistic research lab that is dedicated to those types of questions around life and is based in a biological science department at the University of Western Australia. So what we do, we get artists to come and spend time and do residencies with us, where the condition for them is to spend time in the lab and engage in a very experiential way with the manipulation of life forms. So that's another aspect of the way in which we work. We're not just kind of acting as couch critics. We actually engage. We're implicated in the whole project that we are questioning. So that generates another kind of interesting and nuanced discussion that is really hard to achieve in any other way, because we have both the experience and the understanding of the biological processes, but also our motivations and the way we engage with those new biological processes is very different than what scientists and engineers would do.
Right.
So as part of that...
But you're talking about students... I'm sorry to interrupt, but you're talking about your brief description with students manipulating and playing with biological forms. Is that what you said, just to get that correct?
Yeah, but it's not necessarily just students. Our residency program is open for artists, professional artists. You know, so we had, we have everything from people who just graduated from their MFA program to professional artists that have years and years of practice that want to come and engage with the new mode. You know, because in a sense that there's kind of the flip side of life becoming engineering is that engineers are really good in developing what's called protocols and basically de-skilling, so you don't really need to have a PhD in biology now to engage in high-level manipulation. So by that, they, for us as artists, they open up a new palette of possibilities, a new kind of artistic palette of working with material, which is an extremely problematic material. You know, so life is becoming both the subject, the object, and the medium of our manipulation and our work as artists.
So, and can you talk about any of the things that are coming out of that? I mean, that sounds so fascinating to me. You know, I want to visualize something or see something as you curate or think or look among these things that are being played with. Can you talk about or sketch out any of them or what directions they're going in?
Yeah, so basically at Symbiotica we look at life from all levels, from the submolecular to the ecological. So we had the artists working with ecological systems. We had the project that revolved around a lake in Western Australia that is one of the last remaining, has one of the last remaining colonies of what's called trombolites, which are the oldest fossil record is of similar organisms, and some of them still survive in Western Australia. And this lake became a microcosm of ecological issues. Trombolites are being threatened by human activity. So, you know, those types of organisms survived for about 4 billion years, and now they're under threat through human activity, and we use that as a starting point. So we had, you know, in this case, it was interesting because we had poets coming in, spending time in the lake and kind of referring to that. We had visual artists engaging with it. We had performance artists that were doing basically overlaying the soundscape of the lake in other spaces around the world, so you can actually walk in Dublin and kind of using localized media to basically navigate the soundscape of the lake. So those kind of things, which are, in a sense, from our perspective, are more traditional. Then we had artists, and we have a lot of artists spending time in the lab, engaging in basically working with, let's say, cyanobacteria, the very same organism actually that creates those trombolites, and in manipulating them in different ways. One of our PhD students have been working with the body flora. You know, there's lots of discussion around the microbiome. So here we have an artist that's working with Candida and working with her relationship with this yeast that infects 80% of the human population, but treating this other life form as a companion organism. So a life form that we need to understand how we coexist and cohabitate that body of ours with. So she did things like baking bread using this Candida instead of baker's yeast. We have a neuroengineering a group that does quite a lot of work around neuroengineering. Just recently we had an artist that took his skin cells, made them into stem cells and then into nerve cells that ended up growing onto an array of electrodes that activated synthesizers, analog synthesizers, and those cells that were activating the synthesizers were jamming live with a musician. So you have here kind of an external brain in a dish that plays music and jam with live musicians.
Well, wait a minute. That's very funny. That's extraordinary. How is it guided though? How is that moving? So that's in a sense like a kind of in vitro meet musician or something.
In this case, those are nerve cells. So basically, what we have access to, and this is kind of the nice thing of being based in a biological science department. And actually, we bought, together with some of the scientists in our school, we bought this thing which is called a multi-electrode array. So it's a tiny array of electrodes that you can culture nerve cells and you can have two-way communications with them. So you basically stimulate them with small electric currents and then they respond. And you can have basically both spatial and temporal understanding of how those nerve cells are kind of coming together and send their own signals and how they respond to the signals that you send them. So in this case, the response of the neurons activated the analog synthesizers, and the drumming of the musician, of the live musicians, was what was used to activate the cells.
Right. And then, so the cells, in a sense, are jamming along. Then those are...
Exactly.
Oh,
yep.
Their reactions ultimately translated into sounds.
Correct. And before we did a very similar project, there was a group of us working on a project where a very similar system was used in order to create drawings. So the nerve cells in this case were attached to a robotic arm that was leaving marks on papers, on paper, and kind of in response to external stimuli. So you have that. You have the artists working with biological systems, and you have artists working on the molecular level. We had an Indian artist that came in and was trying to extract ammonia out of breast milk and created this whole speculative scenario of a dictator that is trying to use the bodies of his subjects as factories to make weapons, or to at least make the raw material for explosives, for example.
Wait a minute. And he's using breast milk to make the raw materials for explosives?
Yeah, exactly. He found a way to extract ammonia, which is something you need for explosives, through using breast milk and kind of isolating that from human breast milk.
So that's interesting. That's a little more like we were saying before, a little bit ties back to the also questioning and exploring the role of sometimes monetization, as we were talking about it, by the commercial industries.
Exactly, yeah, and here is questioning it, but also building this really interesting kind of North Korea-type scenario of what happens when you have control over other people, bodies of your subjects, if you like. And by extension, it can be, you know, what happens when we're starting to have control over any type of life form around us, and this is kind of the holy grail of this whole field of synthetic biology. So, you know, we can let this mindset to drive the agenda, or as artists, we can at least try and question it as those things progress, but question it from an informed and experiential place, which is what we offer.
And that notion, as you're saying, as you just mentioned, the holy grail of this industry, to be able to contribute in that fashion?
So a lot of the rhetoric around contemporary biology is about how that is going to be, you know, there's lots of discussion about biology becoming kind of the next... The 21st century is the biotech century, and the
right.
way to monetize, the way to exploit the world around us would now be through the manipulation and control over biological systems. You know, so this is the one of the prevailing mindsets that drive a lot of how this type of research takes place. And you know, the idea of going back to the idea of the contestable, as artists, we want to use that very same mindset to shine a mirror back at society and the people who are actually thinking about life in such terms, and at least make them, at least challenge them and make them rethink. We talk about it in terms that scientists and engineers, especially those who are working in this field of biology, are constantly digging those ontological holes. They basically constantly make us rethink what it means to be alive, what it means to have a body, what it means to be a biological system, but they are not trained to be to deal with it. So here we are as artists, we at least come in and point the finger into those areas that we feel need more attention.
Oren, it's been a pleasure talking with you, and I'm so glad that you're doing the work you do. But before we close, and I feel like I could talk to you and take some of these threads in so many different ways, but this was a great introduction to what you're using. Is there anything you want to say in closing in terms of people doing more research on this or knowing more? Because there will be links to many things in this interview, but for those listeners who aren't going there right away or beyond that, is there shows you want to direct them to or any particular resource for further learning on this?
Yeah, so the interesting thing is that it is a growing area, and just recently there was an announcement of setting up a very similar initiative in the University of Buffalo, in the State University of New York in Buffalo, a new lab called Coalesce, run by Paul Vanous. Also, I should mention the names of the artists I kind of talked about before. So Guy Benari is the artist that is doing the analog synthesizer driven by neurons. Abhishek Hazra is the artist that did the work with the ammonia out of breast milk. And obviously, Yonat Zur is my close collaborator and the person that I've been developing most of the work with. And I suppose just going to the Symbiotica website, it's a great resource, and we've got a mailing list that we send kind of a news digest once every couple of weeks with information about initiatives around the world and what we do. So maybe that will be a nice place for people to kind of get some interest, and obviously our Facebook page and any other type of social media exists out there in the ether with lots of information.
Very good. Oren, thank you so much for talking with me today. I've really enjoyed this.
It was a pleasure.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.